in 7 words. And a haiku of sorts. And if you're very modern, a tweet. And so I asked Junot Diaz to provide me with his 7 words. Estoy aquí, pero mi corazón está allá. Junot Diaz. Thank you. What a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Paul, so much for having me.
Would you care to translate those 7 words?
Yeah. I mean, first, everybody, thank you for coming. For real. Super nice day. For real. I know you bought the ticket, but still, you could be doing anything else. And that line was, that's actually, you know, for the Dominicans and those who love them around here, you know, that's like a Peñasuazo line, you know, from La Banda Gorda. And if you grew up when I did, that was just, you know, one of those choruses that was always on. And I always felt very connected to that, you know. It was a song that sort of reflected the kind of simultaneity of certain immigrant lives that I was in contact with, you know. I always found like music was more generous about believing that it was possible for an immigrant to live at two places at once, you know. Music and Catholicism, because Catholicism, well, no, not because I'm like religious, but because Catholicism assigns that superpower to saints by location, where like a saint that appears in two places at once, they're like, ah.
The gift of ubiquity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I felt very strongly identified with that lyric.
You know what's interesting about your response for me? First of all, I didn't know that song, but you in fact managed to answer this question without answering it at all, which was...
I thought I did.
You didn't translate.
Oh.
Yes. You see, and I think before you do translate it...
Yeah, I seem I'm like deaf to the words, translate for me. That would be a...
No, but what is interesting for me about this is that in a sense, this is very much part of the universe you inhabit.
No, I think you're completely right, Paul. I always assume everybody speaks English and Spanish. Much very problematic for both my lives, you know.
And from time to time you're reminded that this is not the case.
Yes, especially when I'm the one who doesn't know the Spanish or the English, you know.
But it strikes me that your books have... If for a non-Spanish speaker, your books have trapas. No sabes qué. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't understand the words. You're lost. You're estranged. Maybe some readers give up because they don't know how to overcome this feeling of disease of not knowing another language?
Yeah, I think a lot of people give up, yeah. Well, I mean, I think part of this comes from, you know, I always think that, you know, there's that idea that every book teaches its reader how to read it. And that, you know, you've got to have faith that there'll be some people who are willing to stay in the game that you create. And for me, there is a game in every one of the books I've written. There's a game that I sort of want participation from my reader to help not only assemble the book at a line-by-line level, but at a larger textual and characterological level. So I guess part of what's going on with me is I just assume I have this great sort of trust that people will have as much tolerance for unintelligibility as I do, you know? Well, but I mean, I guess I've always
been
aware.
It's part of the reading experience.
Yeah, I've always been aware. I love to read almost as much as I love anything. And any given page of any book, I don't understand what the hell's going on. And I figure most people are going to enjoy a book and still have some unintelligibility. So there's probably that, you know. And I think language makes that unintelligibility, whether one is comfortable or not comfortable with it, very explicit, you know.
You know, what's interesting is we've still managed not to translate those lines.
Yeah.
But before we do, I think
I got to do it. No, now
you got to do it.
It's not that big of a deal. No. I'm here, but my heart is there, which, you know, when Peña Suazo sings it, it's much better.
Yeah. I wish I had heard that song before.
Again, if you grew up in New Jersey when I did, you would have heard that song 40,000 times. You know? I mean, I love it still.
You know, you were speaking about your great face in readers, and last week I had the great pleasure of speaking with William Gibson here.
Yes, William Gibson.
You love him.
He's the shit. I love him. Yeah.
And in this collection of essays, Distrust That Particular Flavor, he says, and therein, I think, lies most of how one learns to write fiction. We have to learn to write fiction, but we have already, to varying degrees, had to learn to read it. And I felt like quite a good reader of fiction when I began to write fiction, or at least a good reader of that fiction which I most keenly enjoyed. And thus are we shaped as writers. I believe not so much by who our favorite writers are as by our general experience of fiction. Learning to write fiction, we learn to listen for our own acquired sense of what feels right, based, and I love this, on the totality of the pleasure or its lack that fiction has provided us. Not direct emulation, but rather a matter of a personal microculture.
Yeah, that's an essay I love, and I remember those lines very clearly. Yeah.
And you write. I mean, you've said it, and you said it to students before we came down here. You met these students from Barnard. You said you write for not necessarily the writers, but for the readers.
Yeah, and you know, it's, first of all, Barnard students, you guys are fucking awesome. Yeah, you're very tolerant with my kind of stumbling around, you know. But I also think that that's a very historically explicit or historically located concept of being a writer. One of the things that I think has happened in contemporary times is that writing and reading they've disentangled them. I find that most writers I know spend more time with writers than they do with readers. And that a lot of writers I know, because they've come up in a workshop environment, are far more writing with an ethos that they're being read by other writers than they're being read by readers. And so therefore, what I've discovered is that I'm sort of the generation that belonged to the time when writers were more securely embedded in readers and hadn't been isolated into a professional cadre with each other. These days, most of my writing students just want to spend time with other writers, which for me is anathema. I mean, when I was at my MFA, AWP, the big Writers Association meeting, I think had 400 people. And nobody in my entire MFA ever went. Like, I did not know a single person who went to AWP. Now, AWP has 11,000 people. And most MFA programs empty out, yeah? And I think that there's a very much a different relationship, because I do detect it as an editor in the Boston Review, how many writers I sense are writing for other writers. And how is this ethos observable? Because when you're writing for other readers, readers bring to the experience of reading, when they like your book, a tremendous generosity. Readers, when they like your book, are always making excuses for your book. They are. It's profoundly different than when you're writing for other writers. Yeah, because when you're writing for other writers, what you're basically writing for is people who often feel competitive towards you. and who
might want to see you fail.
Yes, and who are not making any excuses. You know, and I think that this is an ethos that most people, you know, I mean, I'm sure this is just my individual locuras, like no one else sees it. But for me, I think that there's something very, very profound about the difference between writing for readers and writing because you have been shaped in the context that you're always writing for other writers. And I think it affects the work. I think it affects how much space you make for readers inside of your work. And I think it's generational.
Say something a little bit more about how much space you make for readers.
Well,
what does that mean?
You know, I always think of what I do is that words are just a vector for a conversation that I'm having with readers. And so I need in my work to create an enormous amount of room for the reader to participate. The reader has to have something to do in this game. And I think a lot of times writers, because they're so obsessed with control, they want to make sure that everything goes the way they want it to go, they leave very little space for the reader. The reader doesn't have a game to play in the work. And I often think the most powerful writing isn't just about character, it isn't about a plot, it isn't about your language, but literally, do you leave the perfect amount of room for a reader to play in your literature?
To play, and as Gibson says, to have a certain amount of pleasure.
Yes, and which I think comes from participation. And when you as the writer fill every role in the game and the reader is just supposed to be there and look at your wonder, that fucking sucks, man. And yet, it's amazing how many writers I encounter, that's where they fail. There's just so little room for a reader. Because to leave room for a reader means to abandon control.
We'll get to that in a minute. I'd like to do a little exercise.
I'm here. I'm ready.
I'm quite fascinated by your epigraphs. And I'd like us to look at the epigraph of each one of your books and to discuss them a little bit.
Sure.
And I'd like to, rather than have me read it, have you read it.
Oh. This is my first
from
book, Drown. And it's just an excerpt from Gustavo Piras Firmat poem, the great Cuban immigrant poet. And just goes, the fact that I am writing to you in English already falsifies what I wanted to tell you. My subject, how to explain to you that I don't belong to English, though I belong nowhere else.
It's very powerful, and I had no idea who this writer, this poet is, a very young, fairly young Cuban-American writer.
No, I think he's about 20 years older than me. He's one generation up.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. Yeah, I think. Anybody?
Not yeah? sure. Maybe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Somebody okay. was like, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
I remember coming up on that.
The place of epigraphs, the placement of this epigraph, the meaning of it, the falsification that comes with speaking another language and yet the necessity of having it. Just wondering what it means to you.
And because in different ways, it's especially the national question, you know, are you a Dominican? Are you an American? The national question is usually based on some sort of affirmative identification. Yeah? That like, I am a this, I am a that. And I just really love what about that poem is that it recognizes that often there's negative disjunctions, that often who we are is not just a string of affirmative identifications, that sometimes the gaps and the absences and the sort of simultaneous unease also makes up who we are. I kind of like that shit.
And so writing, so writing in both languages makes for a more complete sense of self.
But also opening up the space where you can actually imagine that you can actually imagine that it is normal for someone to feel self-conscious in all of their languages. I mean, I think that we often like to just think of it as everything has to be this kind of organic essence. But for me, part of what I was raising is that there's nothing wrong with people feeling an unease around their languages. It doesn't make them deficient. And that someone who writes a book can not have that certitude and still be able to communicate, still be able to create art. I think sometimes having having an enormous amount of doubt, does it make you somehow incapable of fulfilling the artistic, you know, imperative? And I think for me, it was there to signal both uncertainty, but also to open up the possibility that you could be in a language that is never going to feel entirely natural to you, and it doesn't make you a victim, and it doesn't make you someone who's a freak or anything. And for me, it's all I ever knew, and it felt completely comfortable, you know?
You said signal, and I'm very curious about what the epigraph in the two epigraphs here might mean. The first one you will have to totally explain to me.
Sure.
And the second one, you can read as much as you want of it.
Yeah, it's really long. So the first one is, you know, the first one...
This is from The Brief Wondrous Life.
Yeah, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. The first one is a Fantastic Four quotation. And again, if you're writing...
Yeah, tell me, because I just didn't grow up in that world at all.
Yeah, yeah, no, it happens. It's like one of these comics that... It's an important comic in the history of popular comics from the main two kind of big corporations that make most comic
books.
This
is Marvel.
In this case, it's Marvel.
I know this because my 11-year-old son is just so fucking amazed that I don't know this.
Yeah.
He just can't believe it. I mean, I went down in the cool level 20 degrees last night when I said, "Do you know where this is from?" And so maybe you read it and then I'll ask you a question about
it. But isn't it funny, that generational shift? Because,
yeah.
Like, guys, my parents didn't give a fuck whether they knew my shit. They were like...
I see what you mean.
Like, my parents were totally invested happily in not being my friend. And in a way, they... No, but that... It's just a real generational thing. Like, I just... And that, in their minds, you couldn't be a parent if you were a friend. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but it's just... I could imagine when I was in the 80s... trying to actually tell my mom about the shit I was interested in, she just would have looked at me and been like...
Did you want her, though, to know?
Oh, hell no.
You? No, I didn't
enjoyed.
Think so.
I have to admit, I mean, not to get off topic, but I have to admit, part of the enormous freedom that me and my friends had in our childhood was the fact that our parents didn't want to be our friends. When I look at the things that me and my friends did when we were 10... and I look at my nephews who are 10, who in their wildest dreams could never have imagined doing the things we did. No, but I mean it. Like, I think that the amount of control that parents have on kids these days is something that we would have balked at. And control isn't always just force. There's plenty of control by being relational. I think that by my parents just being parents, it really opened up the door for us to be kids. If my mom had been my friend, I would have thought three times about doing the shit I was doing. But as a kid, you got to kind of fucking do wild things.
But you know, we will get to the quotation. This does make me think of what inspired me yesterday to show this to my older boy.
I'm
not sure that I want to. I mean, I don't know, I certainly am not going to use you as a therapist. But I'm not sure I want to be his friend. But I want to somehow understand the world that attracts him.
Yeah, no, I think
I want to understand it because I was what my parents managed perfectly. I mean, really perfectly, is to keep me away from anything that even was vaguely connected to popular culture.
Yeah. No, again, but it's a different form of a lot of kind of
control.
Parental intrusion,
yeah.
You know? I mean, I think I look at me like I noticed that generational shift, but I'm like an incredible pushover. My nephews, I am like totally like my sisters, and I'm just in conversations with them all the time. I couldn't discipline my nephews if you threatened to take all my books away, you know? So I'm like a perfect example of this new generation where I'm like a big softy, you know? I don't know, but I think there's much, much preserved in intergenerational conversations because most young people don't get a chance to practice that muscle anywhere else because we've scared them from having intergenerational friendships outside of their family. The average young person is taught if you're friends with a non-familial adult, you'll be raped or molested or kidnapped, where the fact is you're much more likely to be raped and molested and kidnapped by your family members than by any fucking stranger. So on that pleasant note, so there's this, the Fantastic Four, which is for the real big nerds here, part of the resonance of this is that the book, the family in the book is organized like the family of superheroes that makes up the Fantastic Four. So there's four principal family members in this novel. And so there's the grandfather, Abelard, who's described as the smartest man on the island. And in many ways, he's sort of an analog of Mr. Fantastic because he's super smart. And the book describes him as being made out of rubber and twisting this way and that way. And each of the characters is sort of linked to one of the members of the Fantastic Four in important ways. And so therefore, there's this epigraph that says, "Of what import are brief, nameless lives to Galactus?" And for me, I couldn't think of a better script for how dictators that my experience growing up in the shadow of dictatorship, that to me seemed to boil down perfectly the script of the Trujillo. And it just felt like perfect for it. You know, and then there was the epigraph from, of course, the great Derek Walcott. And it just, this was so important for both my narrator junior, but also for my own experience. And at the end of it is, you know, it starts out with this invocation, "Christ, have mercy on all sleeping things," which if nothing describes the post-colonial experience, I don't know. And then it ends with, "I'm just a red nigger who loved the sea. I had a sound colonial education. I have Dutch, nigger, and English in me. And either I'm nobody or I am a nation." And I just like that shit.
And what I find quite amazing about these two epigraphs is that the first one comes hyper-contextualized. If I needed to find the reference to that line, it would be quite easy for me because it's volume one, number 49, April 1966. And the Derek Walcott, no reference.
Yeah. Well, Derek Walcott is, I think, in general circulation in ways the Fantastic Four is not. And there's something joyful. If any of you have ever been in an academic situation and you always have to do a lot of attribution, you know, there's something really joyful about volume two for the Fantastic Four. There's this great juxtaposition.
And there's something nerdy about it also, right? Just knowing the... because when I showed this once again to my 11-year-old son, he said, "It's really cool that he gives you the number. That's how we talk, you know." The numbers of the volumes in which the Fantastic Four find themselves is part of what makes it appealing, is that it's a series.
Yeah, but also I think... in these two epigraphs, it's the only place in the book where the narrator drops his game and says to you that doing what I did with these quotations will lead you to the real book inside this book.
Right.
Which is to say, if you take every nerdy reference in The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde and actually treat it like a serious text and look it up and not just like a piece of ornamentation, and you ignore all the official stuff, you ignore all the history, you will have not only a very different book, but you'll probably have the truest form of the novel as I began to set it out. There's no other place in the book where the economy of how you should read the book is laid out. In the rest of the book, Junior, the narrator, asks you to pay attention to the Walcotts, to pay attention to the history, and to ignore the comic books. And so in many ways, at least in this context, this is the key to reading the book. And I wanted it nowhere else, just there.
Is the Sandra Cisneros a key?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I think part of it is because I owe so much to Sandra Cisneros as an artist, you know? I think, again, the intimate lives of U.S. Latinos before I started reading Cisneros seemed incredibly impoverished at a literary level. You know, the sort of just, I couldn't think of many antecedents who were writing about the intimate lives the way that I was interested in, you know? And I felt that there was some incredible honesty because, again, if you grow up in a very conservative family the way I grew up, you know, you would be much more likely to talk about people torturing other people than you would be about your sexual life. And there was something really revolutionary about Sandra Cisneros' fiction when I encountered them as a young artist. And so anyway, this was one of those poems. It goes, okay, we didn't work, and all memories to tell you the truth aren't good. But sometimes there were good times. Love was good. I loved your crooked sleep beside me and never dreamed afraid. There should be stars for great wars like ours. And there's a part of me that just recognized that in a history like ours, in a country like ours, which does everything to convince people of color that they're ugly and not valuable, to convince people of color that there's another body that is more aesthetically beautiful, that you should desire more, I always felt like that poem for me signaled that for two people of color to actually like each other in a country that tells you that you are a despised body is a fucking revolution. You know? It's like a revolution, man. And I felt that that was very important because I grew up in that regime. I grew up in a world where all things white were more beautiful than all things black. I grew up in a world where you were being taught that there was a sexual economy where you weren't on the winning side. And I don't know, I read that into that poem and I felt that that was important. You know, for many of us in a kind of a, what we would call a post-colonial situation, intimacy has been a profoundly difficult challenge when you live in a world that tells you to think of yourself somehow as out of order, already, always.
Yeah. I want to shift gears.
Yeah, I'm like, fuck.
I want to shift gears and show you something else that is another surprise. We had Toni Morrison before, and you have said that what is more sci-fi than Santo Domingo? What more fantasy than the Antilles? Also, in The Brief Life, you say you really want to know what being an X-Man feels like. Once again, you lost me there. Just be a smart, bookish boy of color in a contemporary U.S. ghetto, mamma mia, like having bat wings or a pair of tentacles growing out of your chest. Now, I've been wanting to show this little clip for a while, but I want to show it to you because it's another one of your, I think, your heroes.
Alrighty.
And here we go.
Well, I'm seeing it right here.
About 3 minutes. You've seen this.
don't know what in hell I'm doing here. I'm the least scientific of all the people up on the platform here today. 9-year-old boys are always finding me out. A 10-year-old boy a few years ago ran up to me and said, "Is that Mr. Bradbury?" I said, "Yes." He said, "That book of yours, The Martian Chronicles?" I said, "Yes." He says, "On page 92, he says, "Where you have the moons of Mars rising in the east?" I say, "Yes." He says, "No." So I hit him. I'll be damned if I'll be bullied by boys. I was hoping that during the last few days, as we got closer to Mars and the dust cleared, that we see a lot of Martians standing there with huge signs saying Bradbury was right. Or even Clark. So, and I have brought along today, I'm going to keep this short because I'd much rather listen to our scientific friends here today tell us about what's coming up this week. But every time I get a group of people together and have them trapped in a hall like this, I bring a poem, see? And you can't escape me. Luckily, it's a short poem, but it sums up some of my feelings on why I love space travel, why I write science fiction, why I'm intrigued with what's going on this weekend on Mars. And part of this has my philosophy about space travel in it, and if you'll permit, I'll read it to you. It's very, very short. "The fence we walked between the years did balance us serene. It was a place half in the sky where in the green of leaf and promising of peach, we'd reach our hand to touch and almost touch the sky. If we could reach and touch, we said, 'twould teach us not to, never to be dead. We ached and almost touched that stuff. Our reach was never quite enough. If only we had taller been and touched God's cuff, his hem, we would not have to go with them who've gone before, who, short as us, stood tall as they could stand and hoped by stretching tall that they might keep their land, their home, their hearth, their flesh and soul. But they, like us, were standing in a hole. Oh, Thomas, will a race one day stand really tall across the void, across the universe and all, and measured out with rocket fire, at last put Adam's finger forth as on the Sistine ceiling, and God's hand come down the other way to measure man and find him good and gift him with forever's day? I work for that. Short man, large dream. I send my rockets forth between my ears, hoping an inch of good is worth a pound of years. Aching to hear a voice cry back along the universal mile, 'We've reached Alpha Centauri. We're tall. Oh God, we're tall.'"
Wasn't short. Yeah, I love Bradbury.
Yeah, you do. Ray Bradbury was one of your first big influences.
Yeah, I mean,
I'd like you to tell us about that a little bit.
Well, you know, it's sort of librarians are you know, my favorite core of practitioners, and librarians, you know, they're sly about how to hook young readers, and for many generations, Bradbury was like the gateway drug, you know. I mean, now it's like the Hunger Games, right? Or Harry Potter, you know? And so, I mean, when I grew up in the sort of 80s and late 70s, public libraries were saturated with Bradbury. And Bradbury was wonderful because he was, you know, besides just being kind of performative, as you saw, he also was someone who, his kind of easy, sort of transparent style was juxtaposed with an incredibly hard, critical point of view about the kind of society we live in. And for someone like me, that was fascinating because, you know, especially in the 70s and 80s, I wasn't getting exposed to a lot of what I would call kind of critical art. I just didn't have that world. And he made an enormous impact on me. I mean, It's amazing how far Fahrenheit 451 will go in central New Jersey in 1982. You know, it went really, for someone like me, it did a lot of work in my imagination.
What did you recognize in him that mattered to you then?
Both a commitment to the arts and the singular importance of learning just for learning's sake. You know, that books are just a social good, that they don't need to be instrumentalized, that, you know, that books are just a social good, and that's that. But also that, you know, he was a staunch critic of the sort of insipid brutalities of our culture. And if you grow up poor and sort of marginal, one of the things you have a lot of access to is the insipid brutalities of our culture. And it was nice to have somebody
in your court.
Yeah, just saying the words. Like, where else? I wasn't at school and people were like, again, I didn't go to a school where you had like these amazing liberal Dead Poet Society teachers, you know? And so Bradbury had to do the work of, you know, of the Teach America Corps, you know? So, yeah, it was important.
You mentioned a story in particular, All Summer in a Day.
We talk about bullying a lot, but nobody was talking about it then. That was a great story for talking about the kind of, this sort of persistent cruelty of youth. And again, about bullying. I mean, there were so few accounts of bullying that were in circulation. That was one of them, you know? And I got to tell you guys, I was almost not bullied at all. But bullying culture was so fucking just present that it was hard not to feel like the United States schools are basically bully mills where you get taught how to be a good bully. And so reading that story was another kind of eye-opener where somebody narrativized not only the cruelty but the sort of complex consequences of being cruel. You know, the story where this young person won't ever see this astronomical sort of moment till, you know, later in life. They've lost an enormous opportunity. And that felt very honest, you know, like when people are bullied, there's a way that you lose a part of yourself that you won't gain back for a long time. And as a kid, even though I didn't have the wisdom of the years, I had a sense that every time we all humiliated somebody and we were all cruel to somebody, that something was lost. Something went out of the system, and that resonated with me. Yeah.
I think this is a good moment to read the very first lines of the very first story.
Oh, okay. The first paragraph. Yeah. Okay.
If you don't mind.
No. Thank you.
I'm going to have you read a fair amount.
Okay. Y'all, guys. Yeah. So anyway, this, again, another one of my sort of, I always have these kind of structural little games. And so this is the opening of this book, which by the end of this book, this opening just sounds, it already sounds deranged, but if you actually finish the damn thing, then it just sounds tragic. I'm not a bad guy. I know how that sounds, defensive, unscrupulous, but it is true. I'm like everybody else, weak, full of mistakes, but basically good. Magdalena disagrees, though. She considers me a typical Dominican man, a sucio, an asshole. You see, many months ago, when Magda was still my girl, and I didn't have to be careful about almost anything, I cheated on her with this chick who had tons of 80s freestyle hair. Didn't tell Magda about it either. You know how that is. A smelly bone like that, better off buried in the backyard of your life. Magda only found out because homegirl wrote her a fucking letter. And that letter had details, shit you wouldn't even tell your boys drunk. Yeah.
Really powerful. Really powerful, and I'm wondering how reliable that narrator is.
Well, I mean,
you were talking about being bullied. Here we're talking about cheating,
yeah,
and deceiving.
Yeah. You know what? I guess I'm I guess sort of where I kind of mine myself to write, like what, where does the sort of, we would call the metrics of which I map my art over, most of the, what I pull from myself, what are the metrics I pull from myself are my profound imperfections. You know, I rarely write from the point of view of a quote unquote, like, oh, woe is me. I'm always writing from the point of view, woe is me. You know what I mean? Like, that whole C.K. Chesterton, is it? This whole line when they asked him, what is wrong with the world? And he responded, I am. You know? And I guess that's the kind of axis. And so I'm much more interested in writing about how much work we have to do to hide and to explain and cover up for our own cruelties and the way that we put our privilege into motion. I mean, most of us, irregardless of our subject position, have access to a wide range of privileges, and we have to masquerade those privileges because otherwise...
To protect them.
Yeah, they wouldn't be fucking privileges, you know? It's, part of it is we have to hide them. And so I kind of love this character because Junior simultaneously tries everything to keep his privileges up, but he can't help but rat on himself. You know,
he's found out. And he's found out in the most terrifying way. There's actually
he does
no
it.
Retreat.
Well, because he does it. I mean, if you think about a guy like this, and sort of the way I structured him is, listen, guys, y'all can date plenty of people who you can do fucked up shit to, and they will forgive you. It's true. On the other hand, Junior dates people who he knows that when they find out, they will never forgive him. And then he does everything possible to betray himself. He's always writing letters of confession and leave them lying around, you know? And I think that was always interesting to me. He is a terrible... I always give Junior, like, a D- at being a male, you know? I have male friends who, under torture, would never reveal any shit. Under fucking torture. They would be like, I didn't do that. That fucking wasn't me.
And they also don't leave traces.
At all.
These I mean, that is, I mean, this is a kind of purloined letter situation.
Yeah. No, these motherfuckers will never hand in their financial aid forms on time, but they would never leave a trace to an infidelity. They're like, it's almost like they're fucking time travelers and they go back and arrange shit. But Junior is compulsively revealing always how fucked up he is. Like I said, he's bad at this.
How much of an alter ego is he?
Yeah, I'm bad at everything. Listen, guys, it's worth noting, you know, like...
Because he reappears also.
I mean, he's definitely my alter ego. I grew up the younger brother of a highly, like, popular older brother who was a real big hit with the ladies. And if that's your older brother, you just kind of get what we would call surplus play. My brother was so popular, he could just shovel some towards me every now and then, you know? And I was just, yeah, I mean, you know, I think like, again, most of the guys I grew up with, which is a tiny dot in the universe, it doesn't explain the rest of the world, whatever privilege we had, we were fucking ravenous about pursuing it. You know, so I was like, oh, girls like me at a certain age when I used to have hair and we went to the gym all the time, I'm gonna fucking pursue that shit. Unfortunately, pursuing privilege crimps your humanity. You know, and that's something it takes a while for you to discover. So, you know, when I was being a kind of a male slut and a cuero, it's all fun and games. Well, no, it's all fun and games till you realize that every exercise of your privilege reduces your sum total of your humanity. And I wouldn't have noticed if my art wasn't predicated on the sum total of my humanity. I probably would have just kept practicing because fuck it, privilege isn't, it's like a drug. But I just kept coming up short as an artist and I had to look for the leaks. And where the leaks are is fucking being a fucking asshole. You know, you're a fucking asshole, your humanity shrinks. Your humanity shrinks, you write whack. And for me, that's the way it worked. And it was like kind of self-serving why I sort of started to think, hey, maybe I might have to change, you know? But I don't think I was all that good at it. My father was like a total male slut, and as a kid I was so hurt by his infidelities, and yet I identified with him, and so there was a part of me also, I think, that just wasn't ever going to be good at it, you know? And so I think all of that goes into when I decided to create Junior, you know? It's like, we often mimic people who most hurt us, which is weird.
Yeah. Maybe just read this.
Sure. And this is in the second person from a story called Miss Laura. Section 9. Both your father and your brother were sucios. Shit, your father used to take you on his pussy runs, leave you in the car while he ran up into cribs to bone his girlfriends. Your brother was no better, boning girls in the bed next to yours. Sucios of the worst kind, and now it is official, you are one too. You'd hope the gene missed you, skipped a generation, but clearly you were kidding yourself.
Bueno, sucio. I mean, so do we need to know that word? Maybe, maybe not. Not this crew, okay.
I was wondering, like, how many Dominicans are out here? Guys, thank you for coming. For real, I wouldn't have a career if it wasn't for, like, teachers, librarians, Dominicans. It's true. Yeah, I don't think we need it. It's just...
No, but... okay, we don't need that, but we do need to talk about the sheer power of contiguity between your life, the closeness of your life to your characters.
Well, just
whether there's a porous nature between them, and you said to me something that I has haunted me ever since you said it. You said that you feel like the biographer of your characters, and you mentioned someone who I've had the pleasure of having here at the library, who's Richard Holmes, who said about the biographical process, that it is as a haunting, as an act of deliberate psychological trespass, a continuous living dialogue between subject and authors as they move over the same historical ground.
Yeah.
But you're different from a biographer.
Well, this conversation comes from a conversation that the biographer and like one of my favorite writers in the world, Gene Strauss, was having with Judith Herman, and I think this was quoted in there. And
exchange.
But I often, and it appeared in the New York Times a while ago. And but I do feel, for example, the first part of your question. I mean, Junior is not me. You know, I'm so much more screwed up and lame, you know? I'm not like half as smart or half as cruel, you know? I mean, I'm cruel to fuck enough. But I guess he's not me. I'm just the metric. I am me. I am the pattern of which I cut Junior out of, you know? And so I give him my university. He goes to Rutgers too. You know, I give him my hometown. He's just an imposter wearing my clothes. But if we were in the same room, you would all run to him. You're like, this fucking dude's cute at least. And I'm like nuts, you know? And so in the way, I use myself, but just to shape him correctly. And while there may be, you know, lots of points of references, I think we're very, very different. Junior is incredibly, a young woman asked me a question earlier, and she was really fucking smart, and I kind of was leaning on her. You know, it's fucking come on, it's Barnard. These motherfucking kids are paying mad loot. You gotta lean on them, you know? It's like education. She had this really fucking brilliant observation. She's like, yo, the isolation in these stories. And I kind of was like, kind of pushing her a little bit. But the truth of it is, Junior is profoundly isolated in ways that I've never been.
And because he suffered some
terrible... He's just way more suspicious of humanity than I am. I mean, I'm fucking suspicious, and yet if I'm in a car accident, it will never just be me in the car. There's always like 12 motherfuckers in the car. And like 10 of them are Dominicans, one is from Guyana, you know. Somebody from like Trinidad, and always feels. And so Junior is very profoundly isolated because his suspicion of the world, you know, is a lot stronger than mine is. A lot stronger. And then there was the second part of your question.
About biography.
Yeah, I just think I write so incredibly slow. I'm always looking for excuses why I'm such a lame, you know. I think I write so incredibly slow because I really believe that. I have to either I have to possess my characters or they have to possess me at a certain level, and I can never tell which is which, who's doing the possessing and who's being quien está montado y quien está montando, you know. And I have to, like, I always say to my friends, I have to make my characters in the full complexity of the term family before I can write about them. And it usually takes me 6 or 7 years before they can become close enough to me for them to start saying anything. It's just another excuse for why I'm write slow, but I kind of believe
it. And what is the relationship between the speed or lack of it and biography?
I just think that it requires, from what I know, again, I have a very simplistic outsider's vision of what a biographer does. But, you know, a biographer has to devour absolutely everything about their subject. At least what I would call...
And be devoured by it, as it were.
In some ways. Yeah. I mean, it's a dialectic there, no question. Yeah. You know? And I think it's the same thing with me. Even though I will only write about 1% of Junior's life in the given story, I have to wait till I have 100% of his life imagined before I can give 1 point.
So there's something very uneconomical about it.
Oh, no, I'm the least economical writer you'll ever meet. Like,
what you say reminds me of, you know, what Flaubert said when writing Salammbô, that in order to write this one or two sentences, he had to read 100 books.
Yeah, and he still wrote more than me.
Pardon? He
still wrote more than me.
Yeah.
And better, clearly, but, you know. No, I'm definitely that way. I mean, I definitely think for each page there's at least 8 books. I mean, I think. And... But I think I have to wait. There's a part of me that can't write until all the noise inside of me goes down. The noise that is, I want to finish a story because finishing a story is good. The noise that is like, hey, if you write something, somebody might read it and clap. The noise of, wouldn't it be nice to have $1,000 if you finish this? The noise of, this country basically only believes people have value if they're productive. All this noise has to drop before my characters speak to me. And so often I feel like it's this kind of weird fasting meditation that I spend the first 500 pages just waiting for the silence to open up. And once the silence opens up, the characters start talking. It's, again, the worst way to write. You know, I could think of way better ways, but I don't have those. I don't have access to those.
The relationship between the novel and the short stories.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're not short stories, exactly.
No.
I mean, it feels to me that you're the perfect illustration of the hybrid, of the mongrel,
yeah.
Of the mixture, of the polyphonic novel, of Bakhtin's kind of Rabelaisian character, sort of ingurgitating everything in your novel. And the stories are something else.
Yeah, no, I'm profoundly... attracted to the idea that the reader has to have a role. You know, the game of both Drown and This Is How You Lose Her is to give readers enough pieces for them to play the game of making, and the first motion is you have to decide what genre this is. You know, a lot of readers will read this and say, this is just a collection of collected stories, but there's other readers who assemble this book and say, you know what, this is a fucking proto-novel. And I like that. I think that that's a lot of authority to give your reader. And I'm way more happy to have my reader make that decision than me make it. Because it's important to implicate your reader in genre formation, in how structures are composed, and in getting them to do the work of assembling the book. I mean, shit, you guys can do it, so why should you? Why should I? You guys have fun assembling shit, so why should I take that fun away from you? And so I think that that's what's going on in those books. I have never in my life written a short story that wasn't linked to a book project. In other words, every story I wrote in Drown, I wrote because I had this concept of a book called Drown that would capture the life of this immigrant young man. And the whole idea was that Drown was basically a how-to guide, a very specific kind of Dominican immigrant masculinity of the kind that I was raised around, how that is formed. And This Is How You Lose Her had a very different project. But I never just independently wrote a story that was just like, let me write a story because to write a story. There was always
this
larger concept.
But also because the characters reappear.
Well, most that, initially is because yeah. there's a larger concept. There is the concept starts first. And then I say, well, what chapters can I write to make this concept work? You know, I long for the day that I can just write a story just to write a story. I'm going to write about, you know, the laundry machines in my neighborhood. But never. There's always this larger task at hand.
Do you feel a responsibility to write in that way?
No, it's just that that's what called me. Drown and This Is How You Lose How You Lose Her as structures came first. I woke up and was like, hey, man, I want to write about this male slut, the rise and fall of a male slut. But I want to do it in a fragmented way. All right, let's begin.
So the idea in your head was the rise and fall of a male slut.
Yes.
That was the tagline.
No, I just jumped up and I was like, yeah, this is it. And then I had to fold everything I wrote to make the project work, you know? And so, I mean, I could have written plenty of stories, but it wouldn't have fit the project. And so you had to feel your way through it.
Something else I'm very, you know, we spoke about epigraphs and your use of footnotes. I am really quite stricken or struck by your use of footnotes. This book has quite a few footnotes. Mm. And I'd like you to read as much as you want the first footnote.
Thank you. Footnote one. For those of you who missed your mandatory 2 seconds of Dominican history, Trujillo, one of the 20th century's most infamous dictators, ruled the Dominican Republic between 1930 and 1961 with an implacable, ruthless brutality. A portly, sadistic, pig-eyed mulatto who bleached his skin, wore platform shoes, and had a fondness for Napoleon-era haberdashery, Trujillo, also known as El Jefe, the failed cattle thief and fuckface, came to control nearly every aspect of the Dominican Republic's political, cultural, social, and economic life through a potent and familiar mixture of intimidation, violence, massacre, rape, co-optation, and terror, treated the country like it was a plantation, and he was the master. Stop there. Yeah.
Tell me, first of all, why it's in a footnote, and here you, in some way, are very strongly speaking of the Americans' relationship to history,
And Dominicans.
And Dominicans.
And that way, we're Americans with a lowercase a. The Americas are profoundly connected through our amnesia and what we call negative hallucination, our unwillingness to see the truth of our origins. And so, yeah, it was for me kind of, I was able to hit 2 birds and 1 stone, Santo Domingo, New Jersey.
Why in a footnote?
Part of it comes with what we were talking about earlier. Junior can't even be a good dictator. And part of the novel is we get Junior acting as a dictator, acting as the only one who speaks. El dictador, to be literal. And Junior spends his entire time both trying to get people to give his narrative authority, but he does everything to absolutely undermine his authority. So he's got the story going on up front, on top, and underneath, he keeps trying to interrupt your reading. On top of that, he does everything to undermine his own authority as an intellectual and as an artist. He lies. He gets shit wrong. He admits in the footnotes he gets stuff wrong and he makes stuff up. He uses footnotes instead of to be authoritative and to be erudite. He uses footnotes to gossip and to make ad hominem attacks. You know, he's the exact opposite. He's trying to openly reveal to you, I am manipulating you. Because that's not what a dictator...
But you're also manipulating us with this footnote by telling us you don't know shit about Dominican history.
Yeah, but again, this is Junior because Junior's so aggressive. I mean, the thing is one of the things, he's got a lot of problems, but he's a member of the radical left. Junior's incredibly progressive, you know, and he doesn't make any bones about his politics, and he doesn't like amnesia, and he doesn't like the kind of what we call in Santo Domingo the blanda dictadura. He doesn't like genocidal apologists. He doesn't like people who soft-pedal dictatorship for aesthetic ends. And he has a lot of fucking, this dude very openly puts out who the fuck he is on a sort of political level in transparent terms.
But this is also your way of telling your readers quickly to brush up on history, to know a little bit about Trujillo, to figure out, you know, who this dictator was. And you, in another footnote that follows very soon after, you say, you know, probably in 20 years from now, you won't know anything about the invasion of Iraq.
Sure, but you got to remember what the opening quotations tell us, is that if you listen to Junior on where you should put your eye on the text, you will miss the whole book. So when Junior says, look up Trujillo, as soon as you start following him, you're fucked. You would do better reading against his voice. Mm. In other words, I would not look up Trujillo. I would look up the Beyonder. I would look up the Dune references in the book. And you will get a way better understanding, not only of Junior's project, but of who the fuck he actually is. I mean, who Junior is hidden in code in the book, and the code is all in the popular literature culture that Junior misdirects you from looking at. And so I think that there's a lot at stake here. Junior's not just simply trying to push your buttons that you don't know the Dominican history. He's picking a fight so you don't look over your shoulder.
So in some sense, what you're attempting is to create a better reader.
Or to the understanding that to write about a dictatorship means that you, in many ways, it's best to be a dictator. You know, because it's so much easier for us to read a dictatorship novel and to sit back and say, see. But the thing that Junior does is he absolutely implicates the reading experience in how we support dictatorships. The same way we give authority to very attractive narratives is the same way we give authority to dictators' very attractive narratives. I mean, the right wing in this country absolutely lives on that. They will sell you a very simple story. Gay marriage is evil. And people are like, I will give authority to that ridiculous nonsense because it's simplistic, you know, it's got certain curves to it. And I think that, let me tell you, the thing about dictatorship is that the same way a great novel works, a great dictatorship works.
Which leads me to ask you to read this footnote.
Sure. What is it with dictators and writers anyway? And here's Junior basically openly telling you, haha, you ain't gonna do it. You're not gonna notice this shit anyway. What is it with dictators and writers anyway? Since before the infamous Caesar-Ovid War, they have had beef. Like the Fantastic Four and Galactus, like the X-Men and the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, like the Teen Titans and Deathstroke, Foreman and Ollie, Morrison and Crouch, Sammy and Sergio, they seem to be destined to be eternally linked in the halls of battle. Rushdie claims the tyrants and scribblers are natural antagonists. But I think that's too simple. It lets writers off pretty easy. Dictators, in my opinion, just know competition when they see it. Same with writers. Like, after all, recognizes like.
Do you agree with your narrator here?
I agree 100%. I was telling the Barnard students, or maybe I dreamed that I was telling them, but I'm just getting up because my back is killing me. It's just, I am an artist who didn't drink the Kool-Aid of his art. I'm not like the artists who sit around and think, just because I'm a painter, painting is awesome. Just because I'm a writer, that writing is awesome and that writing is just a basic social good. I'm not convinced. And I think that part of the doubt I have around my own form, and part of the doubt I have that this form may not just be intrinsically positive, that they may be kind of fucked up shit that is involved with being a writer. I guess that's always been the case with me. And if you grow up in a dictatorship, if you grow up like I did in the shadow of the Trujillato, and then you spend a lot of times hanging out with writers, you begin to notice deeply disturbing what we would call filiations, connections, you know? And I don't know. I've never been one who just 100% says that just because I do it, writing is wonderful.
In that footnote, you talk about the competition between writer and dictator.
Well, because both of them are creating narratives and they want audiences to give authority to. The same access that makes a book popular is the same access that makes a political leadership popular.
You know, in reading that footnote, I was reminded, I don't know if you remember this quotation at the beginning of Balzac's La Comédie Humaine in his preface.
You know your memory is way better than mine.
No. I just had time to prepare this.
So it seems your memory is always scary. I've known Paul for a long time. This dude fucking remembers shit.
What I remembered, which I will quote to you, and then you can remember it too, is Balzac says that with the Comédie Humaine, which has, by the way, 2,400 characters, and when he was dying, he called to his bedside one of his characters, who was a doctor, asking him to cure him. Asking him to take care. If that isn't narrative, if that isn't believing in your character, I don't know what is. But
I will never do that.
You won't. You think Junior will not take care of you?
Yeah, it's not that. I guess I don't have the relationship with writing. I like the real world way more than I like my writing. I will be like, yo, whoever is nearest to me that I love, please be here. You know, this is what I think makes me kind of. I'm kind of just not that great of a writer in that sense. I love the world way more than I love writing.
Leads me to two things, but the first one is a Balzac quotation where Balzac says, "What Napoleon began with the sword, I will finish with the pen."
So yeah, I'm scared already.
Yeah,
I'm fucking scared. Yeah. I don't want that project. I don't want that project. I feel like my project as an artist is to make people more critical-minded about even the thing I'm asking them to be in conversation with. You know, I think that if someone resists my work, I've done my job.
You know? If someone resists your work.
Yeah, because it helps train a muscle. You know, it's important for people to, I don't know, it's important to people to, I think it's very important for us not to grant authority as easily as we give it. I think one of the things that has in many ways overdetermined our political system is overdetermined everything about us, is that we grant authority based on a whisper. And it would be nice if we were a little bit harder to seduce. You know? That clapping, you're very kind.
In the preface,
is that somebody from New Jersey?
In the preface to Hemingway's stories, Living Life, he says this, which, in a sense, goes to the heart of your desire for more life and not just the characters of your books coming to the rescue. He says, "In going where you have to go and doing what you have to do and seeing what you have to see, you'll dull and blunt the instrument you write with. But I would rather have it bent and dull and know I had to put it to the grindstone again and hammer it into shape and put a whetstone to it and know that I had something to write about than to have it bright and shining and nothing to say, was smooth and well-oiled in the closet, but unused."
Yeah. Well, I think that's him clearly articulating his artistic ethos. I just always hope that there's more room. Just because I have an artistic ethos, I'm not proselytizing. I don't expect everyone to have it. You know, I think that's worked really well for him. I just think there's room for every kind of ethos and every kind of book. You know?
I'm curious about your teaching career. What do you have your students do?
I mean, that's a good question.
What are your classes?
Yeah.
What do you expect from them? What do you expect teaching to do? Do you think that writing can be taught?
Certainly. I mean, I think that's a foregone conclusion. Just ask the 10,000 MFA programs out there. They're completely convinced that writing can be taught. And I agree. I think the conservatory model has taught us that complex art can be modeled, you know? I guess my thing with me and my students is that, you know, part of what I want from my students is sort of utopian. You know, we want our students to take ownership of the class. The problem is that we live in a society where we've basically told most people that being passive is the best way to get your education. You know, so most students don't really take ownership of the class because they haven't been taught that. You know, and they usually don't have the space to actually take ownership because most students are over fucking worked. They've got way too many classes. They've got way too many pressures. Most students are sitting on huge fucking loans. And how do you sit in a class and take ownership of an arts class when you're thinking about that $120,000 loan that is sitting over your head? And so we have, like, you know, we ask our students to, as a professor, I ask my students to participate in a class pretending that the society didn't break their legs before they showed up. You know? At a spiritual level, this society took an iron bat to them. You know, and blessed are the few who come in without these constraints, you know, and without this kind of damage. And so for me, I guess my dream was always that, you know, the point of any class is that it's an opportunity to receive an education. And an education one can never get exhausted from saying, an education is an opportunity for you in contact with your material, in contact with your peers, in contact with the modeling of your instructors. An education is an opportunity to be transformed. And I think that that's what I want. I want to use the sort of critical lens of what we're doing in class to open them up to what education does best, which is to transform them. That the person who walks into the class is not the same person who leaves. And 99% of the time it doesn't work. But every now and then it works. And it's worth everything. It's worth everything to have a student who 10 years later is down the line says, the opportunity that you offered me and the other professors offered me to transform myself was foundational to who I am. That's why we do this crap, all of us. You know, we've been taught that you're supposed to be in college because of instrumental reasons, that it's like college
when
is just for a job.
When you say instrumental, you mean in order to achieve a purpose.
A purpose. Basically, college is just
means
preparation for a job, which means that when college is just preparation for a job, transformation is not on the table. Because to be transformed, you got to take risks. But when it's like college is just instrumental, and it's like this is for a job, why would you take any risks? But when an education is good for education's sake, you're far more likely to take risks. You know, I remember when I was in college, again, they hadn't figured out that colleges were a great way for people to pull profits out of, you know, the way they have now. And they used to leave us the fuck alone. Nobody was thinking about majors till junior year. You were like, hey, what major are you going to be? Ah, shit, I got to think about that. Now my students, as soon as they walk in the door, they're like, declare a major. They've instrumentalized the school and have robbed most students the opportunity to do what, to enjoy what schools do best.
This is sad.
No. It's just you've got to paint the cage, otherwise people can't break out of it. If you pretend there's no fucking cage, then that's the worst. I don't think there's anything negative about describing how capital has deformed higher education, because that way we can transform it back. But if we pretend nothing's happened the last 20 years, then we're just fucking keep bumping into the cage and thinking, gee, freedom is fun, you know?
Just about in closing, I'd like to read a couple of passages where you describe women. I find that when you do, you do so with such appetite. And you do so with such such verve. Maybe also some risk. This passage here.
I mean, you know, I think Junior is fluent in the culture's sort of objectification, hypersexualization, commodification, and dehumanization of women. And I think that Junior no more expresses these tendencies than anyone else. I mean, the joke for me isn't that when people tell me, aren't you afraid that people are thinking all Dominican men are like this? I thought the joke of the book was always that Dominicans are just a stand-in. Who Junior says are Dominicans is just a stand-in for masculinity. Moby Dick is not about motherfuckers looking for whales. Moby Dick is not Melville saying, see, and whale people are like this. He's making a larger claim. When you reduce, I feel when people reduce a text like mine to saying, oh, he's saying Dominican men are like this, I'm like, motherfuckers, this is a stand-in for masculinity. Anyway, I'm like, calm down. I need to calm down. Need that fucking skunk, calm. So, on that note, every neighborhood has its tetua, but Belly could have put them all to shame. She was la tetua suprema. Her tetas were globes so implausibly titanic, they made generous souls pity their bearers and drove every straight male in their vicinity to reevaluate his sorry life. She had the breasts of Luba, 36 triple Ds, and what about that supersonic culo that could tear words right out of niggers' mouths, pull windows out from their fucking frames? A culo que jalaba más que una junta de buey. Dios mío, even your humble watcher reviewing her old pictures is struck by what a fucking babe she was.
And one more passage here.
I'm wondering in which direction this is flowing. No, I wonder because I always think so much of this is juxtaposed with like the amount of sexual violence that's directed at women, you know? So Junior has this running pattern, but the book also documents very closely how much rape and sexual abuse and sexual violence flows through this culture. Of course, you knew her. She was your neighbor, taught over at Sarahville High School. But it was only in the past months that she snapped into focus. There were a lot of those middle-aged single types in the neighborhood, shipwrecked by every kind of catastrophe. But she was one of the few who didn't have children, who lived alone, who was still kind of young. Something must have happened, your mother speculated. In her mind, a woman with no child could only be explained by vast, untrammeled calamity. Maybe she just doesn't like children. Nobody likes children, your mother assured you. That doesn't mean you don't have them. Miss Laura was nothing exciting. There were about 1,000 viejas in the neighborhood way hotter, like Mrs. Del Orbe, whom your brother had fucked silly until her husband found out and moved the whole family away. I think I read the wrong section.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But it still was a very good section.
No, I read the wrong section.
It wasn't the one I wanted you to read, but still.
See?
You controlled me there a little bit.
No, I actually, that was an honest terror mistake.
Okay, you can make it up. In The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, you end the book on the beauty the beauty. And this after a book that is filled with pain. And in some way, you are reversing the Heart of Darkness.
Mm.
And I'm wondering why, as we close tonight, you ended with those two beauty times two.
I think part of it comes from just my kind of conversation with certain kinds of what we would call, you know, the colonial, post-colonial tradition. I also just think that as much pain as there is in Oscar Wilde, there is the absolute ravenous, delirious humanity of survivors. You know, like Belicia's pain is colossal, but Belicia's life force is equally colossal. You know, the humor and the energy that Junior brings to trying to describe this life of people who've survived horrors and how much remains intact despite their horrors. I think that there's something quite valuable about recognizing that there's, you know, there's that, always that saying about, you know, all immigrants, what was it? Is it all immigrants are broken, some beautifully? And I think Junior just extra emphasis on the beautiful. I think, you know, in the end, lives like these, the very fact of their survival against all hope and the very fact of the presence of humanity amidst so much dehumanization is enormously beautiful.
In a sense, no hay mal que por bien no venga.
Exacto. Y también es que nosotros a veces es importante que reconocer que everything is not a TV show where you get to segregate comedy in one section, tragedy in the other section, historical documentary in one section, you know, what they would call a rom-com in another. Life doesn't function that way. It all comes together. And sometimes you got to eat a lot of bitter, man, and that's okay. Doesn't mean your life wasn't worth living. I mean, I guess that was the takeaway.
Junot Diaz.
Thank you.
Thank you.